This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Summer vacation season is driving season, and gas guzzlers have been guzzling money at the pump. The price of gas may be changing the priorities of people shopping for a new car. We invited Mark Phelan to talk with us about the latest developments in fuel efficiency and in car design. Phelan is the auto critic for the Detroit Free Press. He's covered the auto industry for various publications for about 20 years. Is there any one thing that you would point to as the most interesting development in the auto world now?
Well, from my point of view, it's the return of the love affair with the American car. And I don't mean American in the sense of where it is manufactured, but sort of the classic formula for what kind of car Americans liked. Something with a lot of room, with a big engine, and a reasonable price. And the perfect example of that at the moment is the Chrysler 300, which hit the market last year and took it by storm. And it is, in a lot of ways, it has all of the latest technology to give it good fuel efficiency and to make it very practical and reliable. But it combines all of those things with the virtues of the old American cars in that it is very affordable and it's got more room and more power and, in many ways, more style than anything that you can buy for a comparable price. And you see now Ford catching on with some of the same buzz with the Mustang that they introduced, which goes back to a formula that's been successful for them in the past. And it appears that GM is moving in that direction as well.
I'm told that the new Mustang was designed with Steve McQueen from the Bullitt era in mind.
It was, and it's incredibly successful. The first time that I drove the Mustang, I walked up to it with no particular sense of anticipation because I thought I knew what a Mustang was and I didn't think it could surprise me. And I got about 5 feet away from the car and I saw a reflection in the windshield and I would have sworn it was Steve McQueen. They absolutely nailed it.
But let's look at how the hybrids are performing now. How long have they been on the market? Like how much of a track record do they have so far?
The first one went on sale in the United States about 5 years ago, and the numbers so far have been small. I believe last year all of the hybrids put together sold about 60,000. The people who have bought them have been absolutely delighted with them, and there's no question that they do provide a significant increase in fuel economy compared to a similar vehicle that has a gasoline engine without the electric power plant. The technology is moving into some other parts of the market now, and I'm going to be very interested to see how that works because small cars like the Toyota Prius, which is the poster child for hybrids, as well as being fuel efficient, they make a statement when you see them. And a lot of the people, I believe, who were buying them liked it for the aura that went with it, that they are doing something good. Now companies are trying to put hybrids into more mainstream vehicles, SUVs and midsize sedans. And I'm going to be fascinated to see if that more bread and butter part of the market is also willing to pay the extra $3,000 or $4,000 that the system costs. Because so far, while the fuel economy is a great improvement compared to a straight gasoline engine, even at today's high gas prices, you're not going to recoup the expense of the hybrid system over the ownership period. So there's got to be an element of social consciousness as well as economics for people to, I think, get their money's worth out of a hybrid.
So you've done a lot of test driving of the hybrids, and in one of your columns you talked about sometimes to get the maximum mileage out of a hybrid, you have to change some of your driving habits. What habits do you have to change?
Well, you have to do many of the same things you would to improve fuel economy in any car. You have to accelerate slowly and carefully. You have to decelerate early. Just take your foot off the accelerator well before you need to if you're just going to be coming up to a stoplight and braking. And with hybrids in particular, learning a light touch on the gas pedal allows the electric motor to move the car without the gasoline engine being involved at all. And figuring out just the right way to use the gas pedal is very important. And the owners, especially the early owners of the hybrids, take great pride in doing that and in the fuel economy that they get. And if you change your habits in all those fashions, you really can get some, you know, pretty astounding fuel economy out of them.
Meanwhile, the Bush administration is expected to give up its proposal to extend fuel economy regulations to Hummers and other cars in that category. What's the story behind this?
Oh, that's a great little loophole. It got its origin back when fuel economy rules were first being put out, and there were no SUVs that people used just to drive around town that weighed, you know, 8,500 pounds or more, which is what you're talking about when you get into the size of a Hummer. The only vehicles that size then were big commercial vehicles, and, you know, things that farmers would use to, you know, haul hay, you know, to the barn, you know, things that were purely used for business purposes, and they didn't want to penalize those people. But as SUVs got bigger and as people developed a taste for things like Hummers, these mega SUVs came along, and it just so happens that they're so big that they fall outside of the area that the EPA even tests for fuel economy, and that is a substantial benefit to them, and it looks like they're not going to be losing it.
Let's look at the other end. What's happening with the mini cars?
You know, it's amazing. The conventional wisdom for years was that you couldn't sell tiny cars in America. And Mini came out with the Mini Cooper, and they're selling everyone they can build. Toyota launched a line of, you know, very small cars called Scion. They're selling very well. And the unifying thing about all of these small cars is that they're good-looking, they're inexpensive, and the people who buy them are getting a full package that offers them all of the comfort and all of the safety features that they would get in a larger car at an affordable price.
What kind of safety features are there in the mini car? You're likely to feel more vulnerable in a smaller, lower-to-the-ground car.
Yes. The Mini Cooper, for instance, they're very proud to point out that it's 11 feet long and it has 12 airbags in it. It's the only vehicle on the road that's got more airbags than feet of length. And all of the small cars are being designed with anti-lock brakes, with stability control, which helps in slippery conditions. Airbags are becoming ubiquitous on virtually all vehicles. And the science of designing the structure of the cars has become much better, so that even if you are in a very small, relatively light car, you've got a better safety cage around you than you would have if you were in, you know, an old VW Beetle or, you know, one of the early compact cars that were sold.
What are some of the innovations in the actual driving systems of cars that might be filtering down to, you know, most of us consumers sometime in the near future?
There are several very, very significant ones. The best one that I've come across in the last 10 years at least is what they call electronic stability control, which senses how each of the wheels are doing and essentially makes it impossible for you to slide off the road if you hit an icy patch. It's just a miraculous system, and I think you're going to see that working its way into cars throughout, you know, the price range. Another real interesting thing that is affecting fuel economy in a good way is that companies are figuring out how to shut off a part of an engine when the car doesn't require all of the power from it. You know, the V8 in the Chrysler 300, for instance, if you're cruising on the highway, you know, at 65 miles an hour, it shuts down four cylinders so that you're effectively driving a car with half the size engine, and that improves fuel economy ratings by something on the order of 20%, if I remember correctly. And that kind of thing is going to be moving into SUVs in the near future, and the car companies hope that that will address some of the fuel economy concerns there.
My guest is Mark Phelan, the auto critic for the Detroit Free Press. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. you're just joining us, my guest is Mark Phelan, and he's the auto critic for the Detroit Free Press. He's covered the auto industry for various publications for about 20 years. We were talking earlier about the new hybrids and new SUV hybrids. In Europe, diesel-powered cars are very popular. And of course, diesel fuel is a lot cheaper than the gas that we use. How come they've caught on in Europe and never really caught on here?
Largely because Europe has always had a tax system that favors diesel. I mean, gasoline is so much more expensive in Europe than it is here. And while diesel is expensive, it'll cost you, you know, a dollar or a dollar 50 less a gallon in some countries in Europe. So that's a very significant incentive. And there's also the fact that back during the fuel crises, you know, of the 80s, Ford and General Motors tried to get into the diesel business with their cars here, and they built some incredibly bad engines with poor reliability, terrible performance, and they pretty much ruined the name of diesels with the general American public.
So you don't think diesels will ever be catching on here?
Well, I think actually that was long enough ago that there's a new generation that doesn't remember any of those miserable old cars that, you know, broke down and smoked on the side of the road. And the new diesel technology that they've developed in Europe provides excellent power and very good fuel economy at the same time. And there's a small, loyal audience for that technology here in the States. It's a question of whether it crosses the gap to the mainstream. The first potential test of that is the Jeep Liberty, which added a diesel model this year. And they had planned, if I recall correctly, to sell 5,000 of them by the end of the year. And the last I saw, they had sold 9,000 in the first 3 or 4 months. And people are lined up to buy more of them. So there does appear to be some audience for it. It's just a question of, you know, how large it will become.
There's something called biodiesel cars. What's the biodiesel?
It's diesel fuel that is made from renewable organic sources, generally. It could be soybeans, it could be corn, it could be almost anything. And every Jeep Liberty diesel that rolls off the assembly line is filled up with a tank of biodiesel. There's no petroleum products involved anywhere in the process, so it's something that is one of the alternatives people are looking at as a way to reduce dependence on oil.
What's the upside and downside of this natural diesel fuel?
Well, the upside is that you don't have to, you know, worry about, you know, where oil comes from and all of the environmental, you know, problems that are inherent in producing oil. The downside is essentially cost. It is a little bit more expensive to produce the biodiesel than it is to, you know, drag it up from the ground and distill oil. But it's an intriguing move, and in fact, in Europe, there are some countries that are moving towards very significant incentives for people to use other vehicles that have got biofuel. Sweden is just moving into a huge push for ethanol-fueled vehicles.
Don't a lot of cars now look exactly the same? You know, just the styling of them on the outside. I'm not a real, you know, car aficionado, but I often find it hard to tell one car from another, to tell a cheap car from an expensive car. They're all kind of similar. Not all of them, but lots of them. Yeah.
No, there are a lot of them. They became a commodity, and that's one of the biggest problems that the traditional American car companies had. They were so far behind the pace on fuel economy and reliability that they mistook reliability for blandness. And we got a generation of pretty bland-looking cars. And all of the car companies now, you see this, you know, both at the American companies and the major Japanese players, Toyota and Honda in particular, all of them are working to find a way to make more distinctive, more stylish cars that you can recognize, you know, at 100 yards away and know exactly what it is. Because once quality ceases to become the determining factor for people when they're buying, then style and emotion come into play. And these companies forgot that they were in the emotion business for a while.
You've been covering the auto industry for about 20 years. What are some of the most interesting changes you've seen in that time?
The most fascinating thing of all to me has been that for most of 20 years, the traditional American big three were working incredibly hard to squander the loyalty that they had built up among their customers for the 60 or 70 years before that. And you know, they were building cars that did not have much appeal, that were not competitive, you know, on price or quality. And the thing that has amazed me is that over the last 4 or 5 years, as brands like Cadillac and Chrysler have come out with vehicles that have the looks and the substance, that consumers have run back to them eagerly. I would never have guessed that there would be that big a reservoir of goodwill for these brands. There's also the incredible growth in the truck side of the business. I mean, 20 years ago, a truck was a pickup, and you drove a pickup if you were a farmer, a plumber, a carpenter. Today, a truck is everything from a little $14,000 pickup to an $80,000 Mercedes SUV. And people in every imaginable walk of life drive them, and they think of them as their car. They don't make the distinction between a truck and a car the way people used to. It's all one market as far as they're concerned. They're looking for the function that they want, and the labels have ceased to matter very much.
Is this a good time of year to buy a new car?
I would say the best time is the dead of winter.
Why?
Because December and January, nobody wants to be out walking in the parking lot at a dealership. If you live in the northern, you know, two-thirds of the country, it's just a miserable time to be, you know, shopping for a car, and the car dealer's business is much slower then, and particularly in December, every car company has got sales targets that they set for the year. And if they're 10,000 units short, they'll do whatever it takes to get that 10,000 sold. So December is when a lot of times you'll see really good deals, because some manager has to reach the goal that he set himself at the beginning of the year. This is a good time, but because of the incredible success that the employee discounts have had over the last 2 years, August would traditionally be the time when there's a lot of the previous model year sitting around and they'd want to move those out. But inventories are so low right now that it's difficult in a lot of cases to find the car that you want because they sold everything over the last 6 weeks.
How successful have the employee discounts been, and what's the reaction been among actual employees? Because they were no longer getting a special benefit by being an employee of the car company.
They've been successful, I think, beyond anybody's wildest dreams. And most of the employees, I think, are smart enough to realize that in the long run, it's better for them if the company sells more cars, even if everybody gets the same deal that used to be just specially for them.
Mark Phelan, thank you very much for talking with us.
You're welcome, Terry.
Mark Phelan is the auto critic for the Detroit Free Press. Coming up, rock historian Ed Ward profiles Mott the Hoople. This is Fresh Air.